April 21st, 2005. We have on our agenda two items, Senate Bill 5523, a work session on the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, followed by a public hearing on House Bill 5020, the Criminal Justice Commission. What we're going to do is reverse the order and start with the public hearing on the Criminal Justice Commission, and then Mr. Kranz, if you're coming forward, just to give you a heads up, and folks from the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, as soon as I have a quorum, we'll switch gears and take up the work session on the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. And I will now open a hearing on House Bill 5020, Criminal Justice Commission. Good afternoon, Mr. Prince.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Appreciate it very much, the time that we were able to spend yesterday afternoon talking about your agency and its budget. And, Ms. Gilbert, we're glad to see you back again this afternoon. And in just a couple of moments, Mr. Wilson will provide us with a fiscal office overview.
Madam Chair, I just passed out a memo, which unfortunately I forgot to take a copy for myself. The agency will cover all the mission and programs and those things. There were no budget notes, audit reports, or board actions during this current biennium. Lucky for them, I guess. And so nothing to report there. On the second page in the back shows the expenditure history, and you'll notice the pattern is rather bell-like in shape, and it's mainly because of the creation of the Juvenile Crime Prevention Grant Program in 9901, and then showing it in this governor's recommended budget, the transfer of that program to the Commission on Children and Families, which is also a major policy and budget issue listed there. Other issues to consider while hearing the agency's presentation are the falling revenue and general fund contributions, the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee, the need or whether the commission is fulfilling its primary responsibility, at least in statute, of maintaining a state criminal justice policy and comprehensive long-range plan for coordinating the system. They've been given a number of duties that are not always directly related to that they are sort of required to do by either the legislature or by the governor, and therefore have sort of waylaid them into a different direction sometimes from their primary what should be their primary focus according to statute. And finally, whether the funding level for the law enforcement contacts policy and data review program is sufficient or not. That is what is sometimes referred to as the racial profile program. So with that, that is all I have. Just to note, to mention that in the pile, unrelated to that, but so I don't forget, yesterday after the meeting on DAs, there was some interest in a table I showed a couple of the members, and I passed that out for everyone dealing with compensation of DAs and the county contributions, and that is in the pile in front of you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. Are there questions for Mr. Wilson before we go to Ms. Gilbert? Please begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management, working from this display. The Criminal Justice Commission budget we'll consider today is $1.4 million. It is 0.1% of the all funds public safety program area budget. It's also 0.1% of the general and lottery funds public safety program area budget. Moving to page 3, We see the budget laid out by fund type. Certainly the lion's share is general fund at $1,000,002 or 91% of the budget. This supports sentencing guidelines, planning and policy development, the asset forfeiture oversight committee, preparation of legislative fiscal impact statements, and general and administrative support. Moving clockwise up to other funds at $31,800, it's 2% of the budget, and this is funding spent to on the asset forfeiture oversight committee. Finally, federal funds at $100,000 is support for the Statistical Analysis Center. It's a federal Bureau of Justice Statistics grant of $50,000 a year. Moving to page 4, we have the budget by program units, but there is only one program unit, so that goes quickly. Budget categories on page 5. There are two. Personal services is 79% of the budget. That supports 7 positions and 7 full-time equivalents. Services and supplies is 21% of the budget. On page 6, there is a short history of the funding. Moving from $16 million to $18.7 million down in 03-05 to $11.8 million, and then in the 05-07 governor's recommended budget, it's at $1.4 million, a reduction of 88.5%. Again, as my colleague, Mr. Wilson, explained, that is because of moving the Juvenile Crime Prevention Program away from Criminal Justice Commission to the Commission on Children and Families. Major policy issues on page 7. The assumptions are, as we've laid out, juvenile crime prevention dollars are gone, and there is fairly minimal federal grant support, limited to $50,000 a year. A policy package provides general fund and about $57,000 of general fund, which is a backfill for the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee, which the revenue for that, which comes from forfeited sales proceeds of forfeited assets, is insufficient to support the activity. So there is a general fund backfill there. The next package eliminates the Law Enforcement Contacts Committee. This eliminates the program from this agency, and there's a legislative concept drafted that matches it, not in order to the reason it was eliminated is because the funding that was in the budget was inadequate to support, again, to support the operation, and while this is going on, we're seeking an alternate home for the Law Enforcement's Contacts Committee. Finally, package 300 is additional research support for the agency, and what it does is retain one position and some services and supplies dollars from the juvenile crime prevention outflow, as it were, in order to support a research analyst. The position that is retained is not a research analyst. That would be dependent on a reclassification. And moving to the final page, the cost drivers, salary and other personnel, expense inflation, ordinary inflation on services and supplies, and then, as mentioned earlier, capital outlay, and that's an error. There is no capital outlay. And as mentioned earlier, requests by the commission itself, by the legislature, by the governor, is the major driver of what the agency is accomplishing. A revenue issue is a simple beginning balance adjustment. The asset forfeiture oversight revenue, while we've been talking about it being inadequate, in fact, is coming in a little higher than expected in 0305, so we'll be adding something to the beginning balance for that. In technical adjustments, there's a potential for an other funds expenditure limitation increased for the carryover of unspent burn grant funds. Burn grant in the amount of $300,000 was used this year during the interim for the governor's public safety program.
It's a review.
A big review. So dollars that were unspent from that, and we will later on get it the exact amount. We'll need some expenditure limitation for the 0507 biennium. And finally, the reclassification that I mentioned earlier will be another technical adjustment. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments? I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 5020 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 5523, Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, and for the purpose of a work session. And Mr. Wilson, if you could ask Representative Wisnot to please return. We'll be at ease for a few minutes, and if the agency would like to come forward in case we have questions.
For Senate Bill 5523, the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, one of the smaller agencies in front of you. It, as you recall, it is almost entirely general funds. The governor's recommended budget is just a shade over $3.4 million. There are 15 positions in this agency. There are very few changes. There were no policy packages presented in this budget, in the governor's recommended budget, so there are very few actions to be taken on it. There are two LFO adjustment packages, which I will get to in a minute. I do want to say, and this is at the bottom of page one, that there is still one outstanding issue, and there was some discussion of this in front of the subcommittee during the public hearing, dealing with the recent court decision on the ability of the board to designate predatory sex offenders. There is a cost, if there's no legislative solution found, there's a cost of roughly $147,000, which we would think that would be general fund, considering there aren't any other fund sources. What LFO will be recommending is to move ahead with this budget, and the board is seeking a legislative solution, is working with legislative staff and the Judiciary Committees to attempt to forge a solution to the problem. If they aren't able to by the end of session, it's either an end-of-session issue or, I mean, this would classify as an emergency for the emergency board. I don't think we need to wait for this solution to be required, and they can be dealt with later in the session. It is my practice in work sessions to use the Orbitz spreadsheets as the work session document, and this is the format you've seen before. I will use this in my walking through the budgets because it provides a little more perspective on the size of the policy packages and whatever. If you go to the middle of that first page of that, you'll see work session actions, package 801, LFO analyst adjustments. The two adjustments here are purely the PERS adjustments that are being made to every single budget and a reduction in the Attorney General's line item because of the actions of this subcommittee reducing the rate from the $119 in the governor's recommended budget to what you approved at $111. The total amount of that adjustment, those two combined, are a negative $57,206 general fund. The Board of Parole for the size agency is a relatively heavy user of the Attorney General given the nature of its work. Package 802 are adjustments that I believe were intended to be in the governor's budget, but in the final version did not make it into them. The first of these regards insufficient funding for one of the board positions that got caught up in the timing of the position being vacant when the position inventory control system, or PICS, froze, which is a term that's used. If that position is vacant at the time of the freeze, which is sort of a jumping off point in the budget process, it returns to step two. The new board member was hired at a higher step by the governor, and therefore they are short a relatively large sum of money for that position. So that is one of the adjustments. The other deals with continuing an increase in a of FTE in a record specialist position. During 2003-05, the agency found it could not maintain its workload or keep up to the pace of the workload, the demands and requests from other public safety agencies. They have approval. They got approval to extend that to a full-time position during 2003-05, and it is their desire and our agreement to that, in our recommendation, to continue that at a full-time position instead of what's in the budget for the 0.75. They plan to finance that by reducing their services and supplies budget by an equal amount, which is $65,242 for those two actions. The co-chairs, when reviewing this, wanted to make sure that that increase in the FTE was monitored in terms of the customer satisfaction performance measure that the board is developing. You will want to know that I did take a look at the various spending, mostly in the services and supply category. There was some room or some flexibility there, but very little. And after doing this transfer to provide the funding for the two position-related proposed actions, there is very little flexibility, if any, left in that S&S category, which is important because a large share of that is either Attorney General costs, as I mentioned, they are a heavy user of the AG, or for professional services for psychological reviews that are required in many cases. And then on the second page of that worksheet, you'll just notice the summary numbers. We are recommending a budget of $365,199 general fund, which is a 1.7% reduction from the governor's recommended budget.
Questions or comments? Representative Wisnett?
Thank you, Mr. So that, Mr. Wilson, that's because of we did the 111, the 57.
Along with, Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, along with the PERS reduction. And those are not captured for the subcommittee's benefit. They have already been captured in the co-chair's budgets.
Representative Hansen?
Madam Chair, I move the subcommittee approve the technical adjustments and the LFO recommendation.
We have a motion to approve the technical adjustments and the LFO recommendations. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion is approved. And Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, I move the subcommittee approve the amendments to House Bill 5051 with a due pass recommendation to the full committee on Ways and Means.
We have a motion to approve the amendments to House Bill 5051 with a due pass recommendation to the full committee on Ways and Means. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion is approved.
Madam Chair, then on the last two pages of my handout are the performance measures. We have no changes, suggested changes, or recommended changes in the wording, but we do have two changes, and I've discussed this with the Executive Director of the Board in a couple of the performance measures. Let me first of all correct a mistake in my typing on performance measure number 2, the second one. In the 2006 target, it says 9.5. That's supposed to be 95%. Little decimal point made its way in there when it shouldn't. But our suggested changes, the first one is in measure 1. The goal had been in 2006 originally proposed at 10.25 and 10% in 2007. We suggest changing or reducing that to 8% in both years. In 2002, the rate had been 8.75, and in 2003, it had been 5.3. And knowing that the base for these numbers are not large numbers, I do not want to drive it too far down, which may be hard to achieve, but I think given their past experience, the 10% rate is could be reduced slightly to the 8%. And our suggested second change is in the fifth performance measure, which deals with percentage of revocations for offenders who violate their conditions of parole or post-prison supervision. proposed originally at 22.5 in 06 and 22 in 07. We suggest moving that down to 19% in both years, again based on experience in the most recent few years, and that number was 19.1 in 2003. And the only other note that I have on these performance measures, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, are the last, the bottom one on the first page and the top, or the remaining on the second page, these are the customer satisfaction, stakeholder satisfaction measures that will be worked on here in the near future by DAS and others that will be available starting next quarter.
And for the record, is the agency in agreement with the changes to the performance measures as they have been described?
Madam Chair, member of the committee, yes, we are.
And for the record, you are?
Michael Washington, Chair of the Board of Parole and Postal Supervision.
Thank you, Mr. Washington.
Madam Chair, I move the subcommittee approve the changes to the performance measures presented by LFO.
We have a motion to approve the additions to the performance measures as presented by LFO. Is there any discussion? Senator Deffel.
Only that it's good to see one. It's good to see Senator Hinman here today. That's wonderful.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Growing.
No objection. Seeing none, the motion is approved. And I am going to ask Representative Hansen if he will carry this bill into the full committee and also in the House. Thank you. And I'll carry it on the Senate side. We will now close the work session on Senate Bill 5523 and reopen the hearing on House Bill 5020, the Criminal Justice Commission. Thank you very much for your hard work and for your timely responses to all of our questions, and we honor your professionalism. Thank you all very
much. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And good afternoon again, Mr. Prince. And I think we are now ready to start with your presentation. If you'd like to tell us where you want to take us in the presentation notebook.
I'd be happy. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Craig Prince, Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. It's funny you say that, Chair Gorley, because I do have, I asked John Minnis to be here, and I didn't want to keep him captive while I go through the budget book. So if it's all right, I would ask if he could do his public testimony now.
That would be just fine. Good afternoon, Director Minnis.
Madam Chair and members of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety. My name is John Minnis. I'm the Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Mr. Prinz, who is the former Deputy Director of my department, asked me to come and present to you today, at least conceptually, on what the Criminal Justice Commission was originally envisioned to do. And I thought I would provide at least some context, because in my history as a legislator, I served on the original Criminal Justice Council with Peter Ozan, who chaired that particular commission, which created the sentencing guidelines that you've heard so much about, I assume, during the course of your work here, either in this committee or in the Judiciary Committees. And I was part of that original group. The council was then created into a commission with a specific charge and statute. And the point I want to make today is the portion of the statute that really hasn't had its opportunity to be fulfilled, and that's the strategic planning charge that is in statute for this commission. This is one that has been a bit of a political football, for better or for worse, in the legislature. Myself included has been one who's had an opportunity from time to time to kick it around a bit, just to see if we can't to figure out which goalpost it may or may not go through. But the point I'm trying to make is that with the complexity of the criminal justice system, and relating back to my previous testimony in phase one on the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, one of the missing elements in the criminal justice system is coordination and strategic planning. And this agency, I believe, is the agency that has the statutory mandate existing to do that, and I think serves very well in facilitating those discussions among criminal justice providers in the criminal justice community. You may or may not know that the governor does have a criminal justice team that meets. We met yesterday and had opportunities to talk about what's going on in the criminal justice system, and the Criminal Justice Council participates in helping to facilitate those work groups. From my experience, it's very profitable to have these organizations come together just to talk about what's happening within the criminal justice system. And I believe that the Criminal Justice Council is one of those organizations, or commissioned, is an organization existing within the state that has been underutilized and can grow in terms of its responsibility, both to the existing criminal justice agencies, but also the policymakers like yourself. I'm kind of a little hesitant to talk about the research component because there is a bill floating around a building that's a bit controversial, Senate Bill 240, that is a subsequent version of Senate Bill 16 that I was a co-sponsor of with Representative Max Williams, now the director of the Department of Corrections, that sets a research component at Portland State University, which is where the Law Enforcement Contacts Committee, I believe, is destined to go right now. So when you tie strategic planning together with research, I think that there are some good combinations that can come out of that when the research is objective and when that data is provided in a way that's in a neutral, nonpartisan format. My hue and cry to you would be this, that the criminal justice community needs bona fide research from which we can derive good decisions. We can make wise decisions about how to serve the communities that we serve. I see the Criminal Justice Commission being a critical component of that, although it's a very small budget. It's one that I think is very critical to the overall planning and strategic vision for public safety in the state of Oregon. That is the full sum total of all of my testimony.
Director Menes, would you, you're saying then, in essence, that the you see the research arm of this coordination and strategic planning being placed at Portland State with the Hatfield School of Government, which is what is identified in your legislation, Senate Bill 240?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
As opposed to the Criminal Justice Commission itself taking on the research.
That's correct, although I do think there's an interconnectedness between the two. And there's a connectedness with even my own agency, and I'll give you a simple example that's very practical. California Post, or Police Officer Standards and Training, is different than the state of Oregon. They do not do training delivery. They do curriculum development, and they oversee and audit standards within the 40-some police academies that exist in the state of California. When my job task analyst researcher was working on some research with the Oregon Physical Agility Test, attempts to contact the staff of the California Post to get access to some of their data, he doesn't have a PhD. And because he doesn't have a PhD, they won't give him access, surprisingly. So to a large degree, there's a need to have certain individuals like Mr. Prinz, who is likewise credentialed and have that kind of an academic background, to help us facilitate access to data and research that exists within the various states. So it may not be a research analyst, for instance, in my agency, but if I can use the skills and the staff of Mr. Prinz's organization, along with Portland State, along with Western Oregon University and those other entities, I think the entire system is profited by that.
Another opportunity for coordination within the system, I would think, would be around grants, seeking not just federal grants, but any grants that could support and enhance our overall system. Is that function one that, in your view, should rest with the commission, or would you see that function becoming a part of the PSU?
Madam Chair, I think that's a policy decision. I guess my plea would be I would love to have access to the folks that have the skill, the time, and the energy to seek grants. Again, I'll give you an example. When I attended the ICAP, International Association of Chiefs of Police Conference in Los Angeles, I attended a grant writing workshop. The presenter in that particular section works for a police organization on the East Coast. Because she is very adept, very capable, and very aggressive at writing and seeking grants, she's literally raised over $65 million for that organization. I don't have, even in the budget that you'll see next week, a grant writer at that level who has the time or energy to even pursue those kind of grants, even though they are potentially available, because as you may know, grant writing sometimes is contingent upon how well your imagination might work and how you can write the grant to fit the money that's available from the entity that might be providing it. And there are different kinds of grants. There's really federal grants, and there are also grants that come to us from private foundations that oftentimes don't have the same strengths. Bottom line is you need people who have the talent, the skill, and the energy to go pursue them. So whether it exists with the Criminal Justice Commission, my agency, Portland State University, if we can coordinate and work together to pursue grants for the common purpose of bettering the criminal justice system, I'm all for it.
And towards supporting a strategic plan.
Absolutely. I don't think we can get very far without one.
It just appears to me, and I'm just stating the obvious, that when you look at the federal funds that do exist for this budget, we're clearly so far away from the opportunities that we know are out there. We just haven't positioned ourselves to capture those opportunities.
Madam Chair, a word of caution also, and that is, as you well know, that in this legislative process, the agencies are generally required to seek the permission of the Legislative Assembly to seek grants. Oftentimes, that permission is not sequenced with the opportunities to pursue grants, too. So it's one of the issues that I think the legislature needs to think about. If the charge is to go seek out grants, then it's difficult sometimes for agencies to go pursue them if they don't have a mechanism by which they can get that permission.
And the first thing we would need would be a strategic plan.
Exactly. Strategic plan is
absolutely
necessary.
Well, are there additional questions or comments for Director Menes, Representative Hansen?
Thank you. just a comment, and that's if you look at the total of all the public safety expenditures, this is a very, very small amount for research and development. And there's, I've tracked this going back to the county days when I was involved in the sheriff's budget and court facilities and district attorney budgets. There's some mysteries involved, some big ones, both in terms of the coordination between the different branches, the cause and effects. If we add police to the street, what kind of cost does that ramp up through the rest of the department? Jail capacity, I think, depends a great deal on the aggressiveness of the police on the street to bring people in, and sometimes those numbers can fluctuate dramatically based on just kind of an attitude. So there's a great deal of research that needs to be done in development to get it to that point where we've got the information to make really sound decisions.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm going to respond. You're absolutely correct, because I, from my experience, I see law enforcement agencies oftentimes piling up statistics with what are in fact criminal events, but in terms of crowding the criminal justice system, costing a lot of money to prosecute through the system, I can't make the judgment that they should or shouldn't make those arrests. But if you look at a strategic plan for enforcement and some strategies that have been employed, at least through the federal system and some of the federal research, we may find that we're better targeting the trafficking of drugs or the money laundering aspect of drug distribution systems. The functional problem with that is it may take 2 or 3 years to come up with 1 or 2 arrests. And oftentimes policymakers, city councils, and such don't see the productivity. And since they don't see the productivity, their willingness to fund it is not always there. But the larger bang for the buck oftentimes is in that 2 or 3 year-long investigation that goes after, for instance, in the Portland metropolitan area, the very 5 distinct heroin distribution rings that we all know exist. But to put money to and time and investigative resources into it is literally impractical, and not to mention the methamphetamine problem that I know you're all dealing with during this legislative session, which exacerbates the other drug issues.
Director Menace, thank you very much for taking time to come over and help enlighten us. And please also know that we are working on getting our schedules together so we can take advantage of that tour that you have offered.
Madam Chair, we wait, and the moment you say go, we're ready.
Thank you so much.
The weather improved, it gets more light.
Absolutely.
Thank you again. I'd like to stay with the public testimony. We have one other person signed up, and that's David Sedanke. If you'd like to come forward, we can take you now and then go back to the agency presentation.
Good morning, Chair. Thank you. For the record, David Sedanke, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. And I should explain my connections to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission and its staff. I interface with commission staff in two ways. I have been a member appointed by the governor of the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee since 1989, and that committee has been staffed by the Criminal Justice Commission, I believe, since 1997, if I remember correctly. And I'm also a member of the Law Enforcement Contacts Policy and Data Review Committee, again appointed by the governor. Before I get into some discussion of those two activities, I just wanted to add my support to the budget for the commission in general. In my view, it has played a very important role over the years of its existence in bringing people together who are active participants in the criminal justice system. And I agree with the testimony of Director Menace that it can play an even more productive role in the future in terms of really helping us and helping you analyze where the system can be improved, how it can be managed most cost-effectively, given the limited resources of the state government. There really isn't any other place in state government that is tasked with that duty. And the commission, when it has been at its best and most productive, has done a terrific job of dealing with those issues. And I am certainly hopeful that its budget will be adequate to launch a major review of the current practices and policies as they affect the criminal justice system and where there are rooms for efficiencies and improvements. With regard to the Law Enforcement Contacts Policy and Data Review Committee, I have provided to you a copy of the current statute, which I know, Madam Chair, you are familiar with, from the 2001 legislative session, which created that committee. What the rest of you may not recall is that that committee was created after a subcommittee of the Governor's Public Safety Policy Council, I think that's the name of it, had been working on racial profiling issues since the end of the 1997 legislative session. And what then Governor Kitzhaber did was to bring together folks from all levels of the law enforcement community with representatives from community-based organizations that had concerns about racial profiling to find common ground. It took a few months, but we did find that common ground. And it was the unanimous recommendation of that group and the governor's office that led to the passage of Senate Bill 415 in 2001. Unfortunately, what happened shortly after that was that the state got into a terrible budget crunch, and some of the funding that had been set aside for that committee started disappearing because of all the strains on the state budget. Nevertheless, a number of police agencies around the state have been collecting data on traffic stops. Some of those agencies have had access to resources to be able to analyze that data. But we're just now at the point of being in a position to bring some of that data together to be able to learn from the best practices of law enforcement agencies out there, not just in terms of collecting data, but analyzing it and using that as an opportunity to improve relations with the communities that local law enforcement agencies and the state police serve. This is a process that has had strong support from law enforcement. The current members of the committee, excuse me, let me get to the back of my notebook.
And this is for Dan. Can you just do a time check here? You'll have about 10 minutes to do your presentation. Is that?
That's plenty.
Going to work? Okay.
That's plenty.
Thank you.
I was planning on taking less than that.
All right.
Sure.
That'll work.
Among the members of the committee from the law enforcement community are Salem Police Chief Earl Myers, Marion County Sheriff Erwin Ramirez, and the Deputy Superintendent of State Police, Lieutenant Colonel Greg Rutherford. Frank Thompson, the Superintendent of the Sandingham Correctional Institution, is also a member of the committee. And I'm most pleased that some of the research credentials of other members of the committee, including we were very lucky to have Jan Chaikin, who is a former director of the Justice Department Center for Justice Statistics at the federal level, who has retired and now lives in Ashland, who has been an active member of the committee, as well as Bill Fireharm, Professor Bill Fireharm, who is Vice Provost for Research and Graduate Studies at Portland State, who has a distinguished career in involving research around disproportionate impact on persons of color of the criminal justice system. And I think you may be aware that former Oregon Supreme Court Justice Edwin Peterson has recently agreed to serve on the committee and to be its chair. And we're very much looking forward to having him at our next meeting. The committee has been reactivated thanks to a contract that started with folks at PSU to staff the committee for the final 6 months of this biennium. And the budget numbers I've passed out to you are what, in my view, it would take to adequately fund the committee in the coming biennium. Now, I understand from previous testimony that there are some discussions, apparently, in the governor's office about where this committee should be housed. I believe it's appropriately housed at the Criminal Justice Commission. I think there are some very important intersections that can occur with the other work of the commission if it remains housed there. In terms of how it's staffed, I certainly leave that up to your wisdom, Madam Chair, and that of this committee. But given its current staffing level, projected out over the next biennium, I believe this would allow us to do our work and move these issues forward in a positive way to try to cut through much of the distrust that currently exists on the part of many communities towards law enforcement. And certainly the law enforcement members of the committee I know agree with me wholeheartedly on the importance of doing that work. One final point I'd like to make about the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee, that has been somewhat in a hiatus because of the passage of Ballot Measure 3 back in the 2000 election. There were statutes passed to implement ballot measure 3, but those statutes sunset at the end of July this year unless that sunset is extended or the statutes are revised by this session of the legislature. There is legislation pending that would slightly revise the old law that had been in place prior to ballot measure 3. There is a court case pending challenging ballot measure 3 before the Oregon Supreme Court. None of us knows when that's going to be decided. But you may be in the position before the end of this session of having somewhat better idea of whether forfeitures are going to kind of poke along at the level they've been going, which has not been all that much, or if there's going to be greatly renewed activity in the civil forfeiture area, because if the current law is sunset, then the old law prior to Measure 3 goes back into effect. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, but that's all I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
Comments? Representative Hansel.
It's all right. I have to step out for a second. But could you repeat your recap what you just completed saying about the physical asset forfeiture committee?
Well, absolutely, Madam Chair and Representative Hansen. I know you're familiar with the committee, having served on it in the past. when ballot measure 3 was approved in the 2000 election, it imposed a constitutional requirement that before civil forfeitures could be finalized, there must be a criminal conviction. That ballot measure was challenged on grounds that it was multiple amendments. The Court of Appeals ruled in favor of Lincoln County in that challenge, but that case has been pending before the Oregon Supreme Court. I think it was argued late last fall. So, I think many in the law enforcement community are hoping that ballot measure 3 gets tossed. If it doesn't, and if the current sunset provisions on the statutes are not extended, then the old forfeiture law would go back into effect on August 1st, but could not be used as long as Measure 3 is in effect, because that old statute is not in compliance with the Constitution as it currently stands. If the Oregon Supreme Court upholds the Court of Appeals and throws out ballot Measure 3, if nothing happens, the old law would go into effect as if the voters had never passed ballot measure 3. The House Judiciary Committee currently has legislation in front of it that would slightly modify the former law that was in effect prior to 2001. But that bill is still in the House Committee, and who knows what's going to happen between now and the end of session. I hope that's helpful. So there's some uncertainty around the future of the Oversight Advisory Committee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
for your testimony, and let me also say just thank you for your commitment over the years, and would also like to honor your great service.
Thank you
on these issues.
Thanks.
Mr. Prince.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and I appreciate letting me have those two gentlemen go out of order to redeem their time. Again, for the record, my name is Craig Prince. I was appointed by the governor to be the executive director of the Criminal Justice Commission December 2004, so just a few months ago. Prior to that, I was deputy director at DPSST. Prior to that, for the last two sessions, I was in the Judiciary Committee Counsel's office. And prior to that, for 5 years, I was a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. And so I say that by way of introduction to myself. I think that's why I was put in this role of staffing the Criminal Justice Commission. I wanted to start by really answering, a question Representative Hansen, I think, said is, what does the commission offer to the legislature for the amount of budget it has? I think it's 1/10 of 1% of the public safety budget or the criminal justice system budget. The first thing to point out is I am not the commission. I think the commission consists of seven members appointed by the governor and one member from each of the Senate and the House. And I think the concept when the commission was created in 95 was that these are distinguished people that have been a part of the criminal justice system, and they provide an independent look at the whole system, a way to look at it systemically, and then to have a dialogue with the legislature, have the governor and the legislature set the agenda for the commission and what it should look at. And then my staff is to help inform the debate and the discussion that the commission would have with policy analysis, with my ability, because of the different hats I've had, to make contact with different people in local and county and state government to get them there to the commission, and then ultimately to have the commission make informed recommendations to you, the legislature, when you have your decisions to make about what you've grappled with already for several months, which is how to fund this system, the criminal justice system, which is a complicated system. So what I think the commission offers then is a bipartisan, independent, broad-viewed planning commission, which is then supported by an executive branch staff that is able to help shepherd their recommendations back to the legislature and then ultimately to help implement those recommendations. That's my vision, and I believe it's the vision that Mr. Campbell expressed to you Tuesday when he came and talked about the governor's vision for the commission. So to look at the budget book, I'll go through it briefly. Director Minnis, I think, did a good job of giving you some of the history, and you can see on page 2 of the budget book, you can see the statutory mission is to have that plan. And I will go through the history. And it's good to have John Minnis here to highlight kind of what it was supposed to be at its inception. And then through Mr. Fedenke, we can look at also some of the other things my staff has been asked to do that are discrete things that are really not part of my staff supporting the commission. You can see I put on page 3 who the current members of the Criminal Justice Commission are. They are a distinguished group of people. And, of course, as I said, there's a non-voting member from each of your houses, which are Representative Olson from the House and Senator Burdick from the Senate. The commission was created in 95. As Director Minnis said, it was really seen as taking the sentencing guidelines that were created in 89, taking those and administering those, and then replacing the old Criminal Justice Council. So from its inception, it had kind of a dual role of implementation and administration, and then also being the policy and planning body that it was to be as its primary function. And I would submit it really should go back to, and that should be its primary focus. But I think that has been a tension between that planning and implementation, and I can explain that historically. If you look at really then on page 3, just to highlight, it was the commission was created in 95. That was in the wake of Measure 11 and then 1145, kind of looking at populations in prisons, how to deal with that, how to plan for those populations. In 97, the focus was expanded to look at juvenile justice issues. And then in 99 was probably the biggest change to the commission, which was when the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee was added. When Doug and Linda Gilbert went through the bell of how our funding has gone, that's when that funding increased, because the money, the general fund money, and then there was also federal fund money, was really administered through that Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee and was then sent to the counties for juvenile crime prevention. That was a I would say, a move away from the commission, the body of the commission. In one sense, you now had this advisory committee, and my staff was focused more on planning and administering those grants themselves. In 2001, as Mr.
Representative,
thank you, ma'am. Mr. Prinz, can you tell me what was the initiative behind the move of the juvenile justice system to the commission? You know any background on that, and what was the justification at that time?
Representative Wisnett, or Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I do know some of it. I was not obviously in my position at that time. I do believe it was looked at by Governor Kitzhaber as a place where you could have the advisory committee between. I think the tensions were looking at wanting to make sure that the funding actually went to prevention and was not in the Oregon Youth Authority at that time. I think that was the discussion, or the, for lack of a better word, the debate. And I think that now with the move to the move in the governor's budget to the Commission on Children and Families, I think it's properly and it's in its right place of juvenile crime prevention. I think when it was in my agency, it was kind of a tension between where it was to go, a political tension, and now I think it's in its proper place.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Back to its proper place.
Excuse me, back
it
to its
started pro- there.
Yeah, thank you.
Madam Chair, that was my question. I thought Mr. Prince said it was an OYA before.
No, I'm sorry. I misspoke if that's the case. Did I say, I didn't mean to say that.
Well, the history, as I understand it, is that it started with the Children's
Correct.
Commission. And then transferred to the Criminal Justice Commission.
That's
right. And we have the recommendation to move it from the Criminal Justice Commission back to the Children's Commission, although there was consideration given to whether it should rest with the Oregon Youth Authority. There was that discussion. Representative Hansen.
If I could muddy the waters a little bit more.
Why not?
It seems like, going back in that, there was this kind of dynamic conflict mm-hmm. between people that wanted to use the money for some very early prevention.
Yes.
And the Children and Families Commission was considered suspect that they might shift it into the very early prevention programs, like 0 to 5. And then there was concern with the Youth Authority that it might end up being used more, less in prevention and more in treatment and programs for kids that were already pretty deep into the system. And so I think the compromise was to leave with planning Justice Commission, and that was probably a workable compromise to get the program started.
Madam Chair, Representative Hans, I think it's correct. And now that the JCPAC has been acting and has been focusing on youth with risk factors that they can identify, and it's we've seen that it can work. I think it then makes sense to have it at the Commission on Children and Families, and I think that was the genesis of that move in my budget.
We just need to make sure there's a Commission on Children and Families right. to carry that forward,
right.
that thinking forward.
And so, Madam Chair, to continue back, so I think I left off at 2001. Mr. Fidenke said that's when the legislature asked my staff to support the Law Enforcement Contacts Committee. That is a committee that looks at racial profiling, collects data, has an outreach component to communities annually to law enforcement to make sure that we're making sure that where there's not that kind of discrimination. That is a role of my staff and not the commission itself. My staff supports that contacts committee. And then in 2003, the commission then worked with the evidence-based...
You know, before you go to 2003, this is just an aside that, you know, that there's discussion sometimes around racial profiling, what it is, does it really exist, And just to share with you that one of our colleagues, Senator Carter, was sharing the other day that she's been stopped several times in her district recently. And one of those stops was around her license plate, which happens to say SD-22 for Senate District 22. And the questioning on the part of the officer was around, you know, where'd you get that license plate? So, you know, that's just an aside and an anecdote. But again, this is a real issue for a lot of people, a lot of communities in our state, and it deserves to be understood, fully understood, studied. And beyond that, we need to look at how we can remove the assumptions and attitudes and stereotypes that lead to behavior that's very questionable. Representative Hansen.
Well, on that subject, my freshman term, I served on Representative Manick's Criminal Justice Subcommittee, and we had a full-day hearing on minority traffic stops in the Salem area. And at first, the first two or three young people that testified, I was thinking, well, when I was their age, I was probably stopped as many times as they were, that I think young people tend to sometimes it's because it's 1 o'clock in the morning and there's not a lot else. But as more and more older people were coming in and testifying that they were stopped three, four times a year, by the time I was in my middle 20s, I've been stopped just a handful of times in the last 35 years. Certainly not three times a year or four times a year. And that really hit me that you don't age out of that level of scrutiny. And then when we saw the information that you passed out early in the session when talking about over representation, if a certain group of people are stopped more often, there more things are going to be found. And that may be the very basis for some of the over-representation that we have in our prison population right now and in our all the way through our justice system. So it's it could end up being one of the real major impacts on how we spend our dollars.
Appreciate those comments, Representative Hansen. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to belabor this point. I think I laid it out in the history. We talked about the asset forfeiture was also given to my staff as something that we support in 99. And then in 2003, as Director Minnis, or I guess as we all know, we went through the budget, I think, environment changed, and then the governor's office asked my staff to support a public safety review, and I think the outcome of that that's you're most familiar with is the meth task force and then the recommendations from that. So that those are some of the changes that have been happened to the focus of the commission. I put some obvious external environment for the criminal justice system in this time has been a time of fast change. You may recall when I first came in, we did a little review of the change from Mr. Washington's here, from a parole-based system and an indeterminate sentencing-based system. You may recall I brought in my grid and we talked about the sentencing guidelines a few months ago. That change occurred in 89. And then, as you can see, in the 90s, we have 94 Measure 11, 95 1145, 96, kind of some follow-ups to that, and then Measure 3, as Mr. Fedenke mentioned, with the was in 2000. All those were changes to the criminal justice system that happened very quickly, and happened, I think, show the reason for planning that is needed to have a cohesive system that can respond to changes like that. And that can hopefully not be reactive, but be a proactive assistant to you in decision making.
Thank you.
Representative Prince.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Prince, do you have any position on where the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee should be under the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisman, I think Mr. Fidenki made a good point of we need to figure out if we're going to I mean, it's kind of an open question whether there'll be forfeitures. I guess it all depends on my budget. If I have a budget to support it, I'd be glad to do it. My main focus, though, really, I want to have on the broader planning for the system as a whole. And so I look at the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee as a very laudable thing to do, but it's certainly a tree rather than having the commission look at the forest of the system and then having me support it. So I think what we have to see is if they are once forfeitures occur again, then there'll be revenue coming in to support my staff, and then I think it's a very illogical place. But certainly, if the policymakers see another place for that, then we'd be open to a discussion for that.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. I'm page 5, Madam Chair, to continue real quickly. I put...
Before you go there, Mr. Prince, I do want to ask you about the work around the methamphetamine task force, which did make recommendations to the legislature. Currently being worked. Within those recommendations, would you say that there is also a strategy for dealing with this crisis?
Madam Chair, that's a good question, and without getting myself in trouble with the meth task force, I would say it was fairly free form. I don't think that if you looked at the 41 recommendations, it would take some assistance to develop a plan and to implement it. I will say this. I think bringing together groups from all the different areas, it takes months, literally, of comparing notes and dialoguing to realize, for example, if you are a chief of police, like the chair of it, Walt Myers, we all look at, if the criminal justice system is an elephant and we're the blind people looking at it, we all know and can identify our portion of it. And it takes something like a task force that brings in all the voices, and you realize, it really doesn't make much sense to get people into probation or prison if we don't have treatment for them. And so there's that realization that you need to have. I think the way that it's put was enforcement, prevention, and treatment. So that's a long way of answering the chair's question of no, I don't think it was a strategic plan, and I think that's why I'm now working with the Judiciary Committee chairs to really take those recommendations and put them together into a plan that the legislature can look at.
So is that the assistance that you refer to, the assistance developing a plan and implementing it? Is that what you meant?
Yes.
Because we do need to make some public policy decisions, but we need to make some smart decisions.
That's right.
And our concern has been that the proposals that are out there really are all over the map. So I'm trying to find out where we can place some confidence that there will be a plan that is thoughtful, that is strategic, that is balanced enforcement treatment.
Madam Chair, I would say that, first of all, everyone has a meth bill, and certainly they're not all. Let me phrase that. There are many meth bills, and I think I do believe that the ones that I put in from the meth task force are informed, and they are based upon looking at prevention, treatment, and enforcement, and I think, unfortunately, the meth task force dialogue and when those bills needed to get in to the hopper for the legislative session we're not coordinated very well. And so I hope that I'm not belittling the work of the MEF task force. I think it's actually been a great process. I do think that the sharing that process with the legislature was not coordinated as well as I would like to, and it would have been. And I think I'd ask that you would hopefully put some trust in the fact that the recommendations are coming from that dialogue, and I am continuing to work on with then the policymakers to make it a tighter plan.
Now, personally, I'm willing to invest trust in an effort that has criteria for evaluating all those proposals, so that the package that we wind up looking at is tied to criteria that is supposed to bring us some certain outcomes. That's how I would like to see us approaching this, and I hope that's how it's being discussed amongst those that you named.
Yeah.
Is that happening?
Yeah, Madam Chair, it is. When we to give an example, when we did the Judiciary Committee did a Pendleton trip, and we made a presentation on that, and I think that the presentation, the same dialogue that the task force had been having. Then we realized which experts we wanted to bring to talk about best practices for dealing with meth, as far as prevention and treatment particularly. When I was a DA and when I was in Judiciary Committee, I think what we heard was there is no treatment for meth. And I think that's false. I think that we wanted to make sure that Dr. Rawson from UCLA, who's done the most research on this, can lay out a model to the Judiciary Committee that says, no, that's not the case. There is a model. And so I think that type of thing, I hope that's what you're talking about, is bringing in a basis for a recommendation and then why you'd rely on it. The same thing would go for the really where I think Oregon is in the forefront of the national issue of regulating pseudoephedrine. What Oklahoma and Oregon have done, we've actually been the forefront of, and we've been kind of the results we've had with reducing domestic labs have kind of, I think, Senator, been the evidence that has been looked at nationally for maybe a national model for that. So I think we've been kind of on both ends of that, trying to be innovative, but always trying to have a basis of why are you making this recommendation, and is it based upon research?
Ultimately, we need to be able to say to the public, this is the strategy. This is how much it's going to cost, and this is how we're going to pay for it. That's where I'm trying to take the conversation. Well, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. After the governor's move the pseudoephedrine products behind the counters, are we seeing any empirical evidence of a decline in small labs?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, yes. There's an excellent presentation that Craig Durbin from Oregon State Police and Rob Bavay have put together. It looks like, I mean, it's very early, so from a statistical, it's statistically it's not been enough time, but we see a 50%, approximately 40 to 50% reduction at this point. Now, there are concerns. There's the concern of how long will it take for the meth manufacturers to catch up with how to get around that. But yes, we have seen that, and actually our federal legislators have both a Senate and House bill in kind of looking at that regulation and looking at it nationally. And so I'm very proud that has put, I think, Oregon and Oklahoma kind of on the forefront of that debate.
Mr. Prince, I want to make sure that we are allowing enough time for your formal presentation, and looking at the time remaining, which is about 40 minutes or so.
That's plenty of time.
But also allowing for questions. Is that, you feel like you can move through this?
Madam Chair, I absolutely do, and I'm going to start moving a little bit faster. So let me move.
Let me take Representative Hanna's question first.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, and I won't hold this up long, but it just made me wonder, when you talk about maybe a 40 or 50% reduction in the labs, is there a corresponding price change of the street value of meth?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I haven't seen any studies to look at a change in the street price. In looking at the past, that's a great way to look at seeing if we're having an impact. I can look into that more. I don't know that. But I will point out that I spoke to the White House drug policy people, and they said that for a long time we were told that the domestic problem of meth manufacturers and what that supplies to actually meth addicts is only 20% of the meth, and that 80% comes from super labs. They tell me that they're reevaluating that, and they think it's more like 65% super lab, 35% what we call mom and pop or Beavis and Butthead labs here in the state. So, a technical term. So I'm hoping that it's actually going to we will see an increase in the street cost of meth.
Mr. Ozan has arrived.
Oh, good.
So you know that.
Well, that would be great. So, Madam Chair, I'll let you let me know if how you'd like to proceed with it.
Continue moving through the presentation, if you would.
Okay. So, on page 5, I laid out really the program overview of on my commission, and as Ms. Gilbert said, we really have one program, which is the planning and policy program, and I think I've made my point about how I'd like to make the planning focus, which is in statute, kind of rededicate the commission to that focus, and then also to make the point that while that has not been there, I have been working on the Governor's Meth Task Force and actually bringing that to the legislature. The second area I wanted to highlight on page 6 is the sentencing guidelines themselves. We administer the sentencing guidelines, meaning when the legislature makes changes to criminal law, my commission and my staff are the ones that work with the commission and policy interested parties to change the sentencing rules to basically react to what you have done in the area of crime legislation. That's a process that we then monitor what actually occurs when judges sentence felons. We then have a database that we keep of that sentencing practice. And that's an area that I'm very excited. We're moving to the court system is moving to an electronic system. I don't know if the Judicial Department has been in to talk about that move, but that's very exciting for a data user like myself and my staff, because that means I don't have to have a staff person who's literally taking paper from the court sentencing and implementing it into a database. So that's another area that we work on that's separate from the planning. We have the Statistical Analysis Center that's supported by federal grant money, and that is, again, basically each state has that Statistical Analysis Center that helps us analyze sentencing data and then share it with our own users and then the federal and local agencies as well. I think on page 7, we've talked about the law enforcement contacts, LECC that my staff supports, and the Asset Forfeiture Committee. We've talked about that. And then on page 8, I think it's I wanted to point this out, that we are the lead agency on developing fiscals for crime bills with the Legislative Fiscal Office. That means because we have the data and the sentencing information, and because of our place, we're kind of central and independent, my staff helps get basically what the prison impact would be for new felony legislation, and then we work with other agencies and LFO to provide the fiscal. That's a very difficult job. During the session, it takes up a lot of time. It's a thankless job because it usually means we're telling a representative or senator how much the bill that their community cares about will cost. I think it's an important function. And incidentally, it's not a statutory function. It's just one that we have taken on. So those are the program areas.
Representative Hanna has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along with that, are you involved? There's a number of bills or bills that have been discussed that would say the increase of credit or time served from the 23% to 33%. Mm-hmm. Those types. I can't remember the bill number, but do you look at that as well and say, here's what the savings might be, or here's how that would affect the forecast?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, Mr. Wilson had me in his office yesterday on that bill, and we do work on those. And absolutely. That's definitely a part of our function. We work with corrections that has a lot of data. The Office of Economic Analysis has a lot of data. And the LFO, what my staff bring is experience from the criminal justice system. A lot of those people don't have, are not able to make an informed assumption about how it'll be applied in court. So we do help with that.
I'll follow up, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
Given that kind of conversation that's going on, so you and Mr. Wilson meet, do you then, within some function, say, do you get together with the director from the Department of Corrections and say, hey, this bill's on the radar screen, here's how it might affect you in terms of number of inmates, or here's how it might affect your roll out from the system, in other words, and get response?
Madam Chair and Representative Hanna, usually the conversation is with the Department of Corrections budget analysts, and so we work with the budget analyst to develop the fiscal, and then I'm sure Mr. Williams reviews that. But yes, it's a dialogue with all those parties.
Thank you.
You bet. Moving through the pages 9 and 10, I want to highlight page 9 is my agency as it stands now. Page 10, this is important, this would be the position authority of my agency after the JCP move that's contemplated. I want to highlight on the org chart, this position here that's on the lower right is basically when I talk about retaining a position when the move is made in our policy option package. This is the position that I'm hoping and is in the governor's budget to help support, actually supporting the commission. It's that program Tech 2. And so I want to highlight that. Moving to the performance measures.
Madam Chair.
A representative, isn't it?
Mr. Prince, real quick, your budget accounting then is helping you do this analysis or determination. It's not, you don't have a budget accounting to do your monitor your money, do you?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not sure I understand. Stan, could you repeat the...
Chair, what's the responsibility of that position, budget accounting?
Oh, budget accounting, I see here. With the grants, there's a lot of accounting that we're currently administering the JCP grants. I think the contemplation is when that goes away, our whole function as an organization will be changed. It's a discussion we'll have to have about how we're going to do our budgeting and accounting when we become a smaller agency. This shows the position authority, but not necessarily how the organization will look. Does that answer the question?
Okay, we're going to address that later.
Madam Chair, I think that's one of the things the subcommittee will need to take a look at, because it is a much smaller agency financially, and it's just something we need to look at. The responsibilities have shrunk.
You can have DAS do it for twice as much. Sorry.
Are you trying to get me in trouble with my friends here? I want to highlight the performance measures very quickly, because almost all of our performance measures were related to the JCP function and measuring the outcomes for that juvenile crime prevention grant program. We have very few performance measures left. I've already met with Jeff Tryons, and I think that we're going to need to develop new ones. If if this goes as planned, I think my main one will be getting a plan to the legislature for, you know, for next session, actually doing a strategic plan. So, Madam Chair, I don't know if you want me to focus any more on these. I almost, the performance measures are kind of in transition, and I feel the ones we have are not well applied to where I think the commission will be as in the governor's budget.
Well, I think your point is correct that we would need to establish a strategic plan first from which performance measures could then be developed.
That's correct. And that's correct, Madam Chair. And when I spoke with Mr. Tryon's, that's the point he made and said you might want to, you know, obviously you want to have a plan, first of all, and that would be, in one sense, what we would provide, number one, and be the, but then need to actually develop that. So I'm working on that, and I think it'll be an ongoing dialogue.
I think what we would need to clarify, though, for the record, is that there is the expectation that there will be a strategic plan developed.
Correct.
And that it will be ready by a time certain, date
that's
certain.
That's correct. And,
and I think we need to negotiate that with you so that we're looking realistically at when we could expect that to happen.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you make a recommendation to the Children and Families or Commission on Children and Families to use these performance measures if they were based on the JCP?
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative, let me see, make sure I understand your question. The ones that we had, are they retaining them with the move to the Commission on Children and Families? Is that your question?
Well, it could be that. I'm not asking whether they're retaining them. Would you recommend they do?
That's a good question. That I'll have to ask my staff and see if that was made as I come in December. I did not make any formal recommendation like that, but be happy to have that answered for you.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. Just, again, we've been through in all of our committees all these performance measures, and, you know, while these are juvenile crime prevention funds, mostly for youth, like the benchmark 64, the percentage of offenders released from prison who are convicted of a felony within 3 years of release. That's a tough one for me to put together with youth. I'm on page 11.
Oh.
And I don't know which ones you...
I see.
You're specifically relating to.
I see. Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, these are the ones that remain. So these are not the ones that went over. So I guided you. Right. These are not the ones. These are basically the remains of what left.
Thank you.
Yeah. Madam Chair, to continue, page 13 is our priority list. As you can see, it's page 13 and 14 are very short because it's a small agency. I don't know that I need to go through those. If I don't need to, Madam Chair, I'll just move on.
You know, it's maybe it's just me, but I think that before the word planning, there needs to be the word strategic.
Mm-hmm.
Again, establishing this is not just planning.
Right.
It's strategic planning for a system as we know it, trying to evolve into a more coherent system, and you have a role to play in helping to make that happen.
Madam Chair, I think it's a good point because I think that a plan in the past, you know, I don't want the plan to be something you do and you put on a shelf. It doesn't really help. It needs to be, again, the concept would be you and the governor's office set the agenda. We then inform ourselves with data and we make recommendations based upon that. To me, that's the plan, and that's how I'd like to see it. Skipping to my page 15, I will just very quickly highlight, you've already covered most of this, the budget drivers, I think, again, were pointed out, really the commission, the legislature, and the governor drive the my agency's budget. The environmental factors that I highlighted are the Blakely case, which I think you've probably heard about. That, depending on how that legislative response to the Blakely case, which is, I think, Senate Bill 528, that would impact, it will impact how our guidelines are applied. At this point, the legislation I've seen would retain the guidelines basically as they are, and the bill would then create a statutory means of having those things that need to be decided by a jury rather than a judge. For the guidelines, you'd have an ability to do that. If you want me to get into the technicality of that, I will, but that will be a thing that I'll be working on between now and next session. The asset forfeiture in Measure 3, I think Mr. Fedenke explained well. Major changes in the last 10 years, you can, I think, I've also highlighted with the history and with this budget table, kind of the changes in the commission have been dramatic. And then basically to sum up, I want to, you know, I think Sir Gorley, Madam Chair, you've pointed out really improving the program delivery is making, you know, getting the strategic planning where it ought to be. And that's really the focus. Professional services and purchasing contracts, as has been mentioned, we do have contracts that we currently have with PSU to support the LECC. We also contract with the University of Oregon. In Mr. Fedenke's handout, I think he handed this out, where it says OASIS Public Perception Survey. University of Oregon helps us work with that data to get information from citizens about contacts with law enforcement. We work with the University of Oregon on that. We're also working with Oregon Partnership and the University of Oregon on implementing an anti-meth public service announcements, and that is part of the burn grant money that was mentioned when we put together the public safety review. We're using some of that to do a public service announcements, and we're working with the University of Oregon and Oregon Partnership to do that, which leaves really the I just want to, because Mr. Azan is here, and I think we've talked about a lot of this, the budgetary issues really are the asset forfeiture issue of funding, back funding with general fund if the asset forfeiture funds are not adequate. However, there was some asset forfeiture activity, more than we anticipated, as Ms. Gilbert said, and we can work on that with Mr. Wilson and the staff to make sure we've got the right numbers there for the other fund. And that really leads me to the last point I wanted to make, and then I'll just wait for answer any questions and let Mr. Azan speak. Is the package 300 is really the focus I wanted to bring your attention to. That's why I pointed out to the org chart. That package, the way I understand it in budget terminology, and Mr. Wilson and Ms. Gilbert can say this the correct way, but that position authority would be retained when the JCP move is made. That position would be retained and allow me to use that to really support the commission, the primary focus, what the commission should be with the staff to do the analysis. And so with that, I will conclude and hope to answer any questions you have, or if you want to have Mr. Azan.
Representative Lisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation, Mr. Prince. I think the Chief Justice talked along about this, and I didn't understand as much as I do now after this presentation. It seems like this is definitely something that we need. It sounds like you're sort of a catch-all for whoever wants a project that they turn it over to you, and thus we're not getting that strategic planning we need. I guess my only question is, how is your duties? Do you report to the board, and do they determine your day-to-day duties? Or and do we need to look at some different legislation to be sure that we make these people do what it was created for?
Ma- Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, that's a good question. I see it as a tension between what my staff is asked to do kind of by the governor's office and the legislature and then supporting the commission. I serve kind of a dual function myself. I support, like, for example, with I'm saying the meth task force. I feel like I'm supporting that for the governor's office. I don't think, as far as your question about legislation, there is a bill, Senate Bill 95, and this is a good example of how my agency gets involved in things, implementing things rather than supporting the systemic plan. Senate Bill 95 was put in. It would increase the number of commissioners from 9 to 15. Now, the reason that we wanted to do that was so we could actually have a commission that was of a size that you could break it into subcommittees and actually do some work. And I think it's a good idea. When we heard that bill in the Senate, there were amendments proposed to that. Because my commission staff and the meth task force has been, I think, on the forefront of having the legislature look at drug courts as a really viable model for treatment for meth addicts particularly, there were amendments proposed to actually have my commission be kind of the administrators of those drug courts because they take so many parts of the system. A drug court requires a judge, a DA, I think you heard from the DAs yesterday, DA, defense attorney, treatment, and a local jail bed. Well, I'm kind of in a great position to do that type of thing because of my independence and the way I'm seen in government. The problem is and I want to do that type of thing. It's a great mission, but it does take me away from the planning focus. So, yeah, I feel it's probably just as much historically the staff has been as divided, and I don't think it's the commission.
One quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for those comments. But I mean, my experience has been adding more board commissioners, do they do the work or just give you the tasking? And also then I would question, you know, is it the commission was not set up to augment the governor's staff. And you want to help the governor, you want to work, you know, the issues. But if you're being, you know, tasked too much by the governor, then that seems to be taken away from what the original intent of this commission is. So those comments.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, I think that having more commissioners, I'm hoping that my idea would be more like the Oregon Law Commission, where you have enough to actually have a subcommittee that has a commissioner on it, rather than my staff doing all of the work. We would still be supporting that, but I think it would actually make my job easier. As far as working for the governor's agenda, I mean, I think the history of the commission, again, because of its central, independent place, and because my staff is in that same position, you know, the governor and the legislature have both seen that and have wanted to use that. And the hard thing is it's all been for laudable, good things. But I think, unfortunately, it's diluted the focus on the planning, and I think the governor's office would like to get that refocused there, and I hope that the legislature sees that's something that is valuable that we can offer. So with that, I'll conclude.
In addition to added numbers to the commission, you are also suggesting that you need additional perspectives.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
That can assist in the development of the strategic plan. Certainly there would be other partners involved in helping to develop the strategic plan.
That's a great point. I should have brought up, thank you for reminding me of that. If you look at the commissioners, there's an amendment that Senator Burdick proposed to Senate Bill 95 was to make sure there's always a practicing district attorney and a practicing defense attorney on the commission if we expand it. If you looked at the system, the criminal justice system of kind of a police and enforcement the court system and really what I think of as a very expensive and complicated dispute resolution in, you know, is the person guilty or not guilty? And then what do you do with those people once they've been convicted? The commission, they're folks that are from, you know, they're attorneys and from that kind of the court system. So to follow up on the chair's comments, I think we need viewpoint diversity to get comments like Director Minnis would make and people from, say, community corrections. And I'm thinking, I'm hoping that in we'll have more, those voices will be helpful also. Thank you for helping me remember that.
Certainly. Are you at your conclusion now?
You,
or would you like Mr. Ozan to come up and
I'd
join
love
you,
to, Mr.
if
Ozan,
you would? And as Mr. Ozan is approaching, I just recall when you were with us earlier during the public safety system overview, and then again when we heard when we were hearing your budget, you provided what I thought was some of the most thoughtful and provocative testimony around the Criminal Justice Commission and what could be an enhanced role to bring more coherence and thoughtful planning to our system of, to our public safety system, including the judicial side. And wanted to provide an opportunity for you to come back as we are now hearing the agency budget to further expand on your earlier thoughts. So thank you for being here.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm, members of the committee, I'm honored and thank you for your gracious comments. I really think the reason you asked me to be here is I was dumb enough to spend some time when I should have been talking about my own agency, talking about Craig's, but I do believe that it is the single most important agency in the public safety system, in my view. I did have some experience in, and I spoke yesterday about prosecutors, and I think probably they're the next most important when you think about power and influence in the system. And I hope you will take my remarks as they are presumptuous. I have nothing, no particular knowledge about the details of the budget, and I know you have conflicting demands on the spending, so what I say I hope you'll take in an effort of to explain at least what I think this committee and the legislature should think about in the long term. I think my comments in particular would suggest, and I do recollect, though I'm by no means expert in your procedures, that the Ways and Means Committee or other committees could drop notes and footnotes for directions for interim's activities, and I think it would be well worth it to all of us in Oregon to have an interim exploration of the directions for the commission and the capacities of the commission and the investment in the commission. And I, for one, would certainly be willing to serve on any activity like that. If I apologize that I didn't have time to prepare written testimony today, and I'm happy to prepare some testimony or a white paper to follow up on this. So let me say that, first of all, Madam Chair, Representative Wisman, I think you put your finger on really one of the main questions is what is the highest and best use for this commission? And what should be the focus of the Criminal Justice Commission? And in my mind, it is the nerve center of the public safety system. It ought to be. You are essentially, in my view, when you see us public agencies come here and testify, you remember President Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex. You are confronting a criminal justice-industrial complex. We all have our reasons for presenting our budgets and our cases to be made, and I think you need something like a commission and independent staff to pierce through the viewpoints of the agencies. We all try to be objective and fair, but we're coming with our own perspectives and, frankly, our own axes to grind. I don't want to be disrespectful in the era of Pope Benedict the 16th. I happen to be, one of my hobbies is theology, or one of my interests is theologies. But in public safety, in my mind, we have to rid ourselves of theology. We all have theologies, and most of the policy discussions are at the level of theology or ideology. So when, Madam Chair, Representative Wisnat, when you asked about, and I think it's very appropriate that the commission be involved in planning. Planning is no good, in my opinion, unless you've got research, data, and analysis to underlie that planning. Otherwise, you have a group, whether they're 3, 5, or 12, just sitting around debating about their own particular world views about public safety. Because as we know, everyone knows what the answers are. The problem is we never test to see if any of them really work in general in the public safety system. So it would be kind of like combining, forming a board of directors for a company and not providing them with any financial data to run the company. And that's essentially what we do in so many of these policy groups. So my point for you today is really in the long run to consider building research capacity and analytical capacity, primarily for your use, not for certainly and the governor's, but not for the uses of the agency, just really to give you the guidance and ultimately a plan. But the plan, like in business, can only be based on data and analysis. I think in the interim, and by the way, I should back up and say I've just sketched out a few notes here, the kind of examples when I say, and I'm a bit flippant when I say theology, we talk about prevention, enforcement, and treatment as strategies. And then we talk about personal accountability, and we also talk about social forces like poverty, lack of education, as causes or solutions to the criminal problems. The problem for us is all of those things are true, or all of those things have the right place. The question is, where in an array of strategies and strategic interventions we ought to put those priorities? And the problem we have without analysis of what works, without analysis of the data, we're essentially flying blind. And with all due respect, I think generally the state of Oregon, in the main, with some exceptions, is flying blind in public safety based on these notions without the kind of analytical data that we need. So what I would respectfully suggest as an interim project is, number one, we would look to states that have attempted, and it's always an attempt, some are better than others, an attempt to build this analytical capacity. And I think it's fine to have a commission to direct it and ultimately take the data and convey it to you, but whether it's 5 or 7 or 10 commissioners, without the analytical capacity, it's essentially another unguided missile. We don't know where it's going to wind up, and frankly, the suggestions, you won't know whether they're going to work or not until you spend a lot of money and pass a lot of statutes. So that you need that analytical capacity. And as I mentioned earlier, when I had an opportunity to speak, or at least when I was speaking on my own agency budget and took some time to talk about Craig's, I thought that Washington and Texas were states that have made efforts and are places that I know in the past the director of the Washington office came down here and spoke. It's kind of like the state economist. He has an office with an analytical capacity, and they could give us a sense of what we need to invest in. I think we're talking about at least one, maybe more, PhD level researchers guided by in this case Craig as the director of the office, but somebody who really can gather and analyze data, and you're probably going to need more than that. I think it's important enough to consider radical, and here's probably where I'm going to fall on my sword if not lose my job, solutions to contributing to this. You know, the Attorney General charges billable hours in each agency to get the money to run the Department of Justice. What about a public safety tithe? What about a contribution from each public safety agency, or a contribution in research capacity to assist Craig in this regard? That not directed from somebody like me, but essentially donated over to Craig so that he can do this analysis. So I think we have to think about ways to marshal the resources to get this done. And then finally, you know, we talked a lot about performance measures. As you know, we are struggling with performance measures, and I find it to be, from yesterday's testimony, an excellent thing that the prosecutors are talking about performance measures, and we're gathering under the auspices of the Chief Justice to develop performance measures. But why shouldn't the Criminal Justice Commission be the place for public safety agencies to develop their performance measures? With all due respect to the Progress Board, when I talk to them, they're the first one to admit that they really don't understand the public safety system, and they pretty much take our performance measures with some, you know, some nitpicking and some tough questions, but they're not in a place where they have the expertise to develop those performance measures. And why shouldn't the Criminal Justice Commission develop those? Again, to guide this currently unguided missile to a route and direction that we all want, which is more effective public safety and safer Oregon. I think we all want that. The question is which of the various strategies is the one most effective to get there, and without data and analysis, I don't believe we'll ever get there. Oh, one more thing, Madam Chair, if I may. This is just from accumulated scar tissue. I ran a project for the U.S. Department of Justice in which there was a partnership between universities all the way from the Harvard Kennedy School to Reed in Portland State, in which we were in five cities and we partnered with a local university to develop research and data on youth gun violence and develop street-level strategies to reduce gun violence among youth. From that experience, which lasted about 3 years working with university researchers, I think university researchers are wonderful. I spent 10 years at the University of Oregon. I think there's a lot of talent there. I would respectfully urge that the investment and research capacity be in-house research capacity. You need to hire and train the research capacity on site. A university researcher is just not attuned to the needs and demands of a public agency or of the legislature, and besides the need to write and get tenure, you can't capture their attention sufficiently. You really, I think, in the long run, really need to build that research capacity in-house. I think it's fine for the interim to contract with whoever in the university system. I think there's always a place for it, but you need to build a critical mass internally. So obviously what I'm talking about is a long-term issue, but I think we're going maybe in the wrong direction. Certainly if the Criminal Justice Commission's budget's shrunk by any other reason than just the exigencies of the fiscal situation, we need to build capacity here and not reduce it. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ozan, for those excellent comments. And I have a request of staff. I'd like to have Mr. Ozan's comments and Mr. Fedenke's comments, also Director Minnis' comments, captured in the form of a document, as their testimony has been delivered to us, captured in a document that can be shared with the committee. I'd like the document to highlight the recommendations that and suggestions that were made through the testimony. And if we could get that as soon as possible and have an opportunity to review it and discuss it, that would be wonderful. And we'll take it from there. And again, thank you very much for your participation. Mr. Prinz, we thank you for your hard work. And colleagues, did you have any additional comments for the?
I just want to make sure that there was no one else in the audience that would like to testify on this bill or this budget.
Is there anyone else here who wanted to testify on the Criminal Justice Commission? Okay. Colleagues, next week the Phase 2 presentations by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training is scheduled for Monday and Tuesday, followed by the State Police on Wednesday and Thursday. I'd also like to provide an update on Senator Winters. She's doing well, looks wonderful, great spirit and energy. She's with us during the mornings in floor session, and she's working her way back toward being with us. Again, she's been following the progress of this this committee and sends her regards and encouragement. And again, she looks forward to coming back and being with us. I'd like to introduce my sister, Faye Birch, who has joined us. Great to see you. I never get to see my sister when I'm down here, so it's really great. And we're a public policy-making family. She served during the Roberts administration. Faye Birch Wilson served during the Roberts administration as a senior policy advisor.
She was bragging about you the other night.
If there's no further business, then we are adjourned. Thank you.